Like so many young people in 1990s Harlem, he was raised on the streets and found his purpose in a gang. He was sentenced to 50 years in prison and spent the next 25 trying to prove he'd done his time, changed for the better. But as soon as he got out, he allegedly dismembered the body of a childhood friend. This is the story of Sheldon Johnson, the freed inmate who was found with a head in the freezer. Hi friends, I'm Katie, and this is Katie Does Crime. Thank you for joining me for the first time if you're new here, and hello to the usual rapscallions and reprobates. Please consider subscribing or joining me on Patreon if you'd like to hear more true crime stories. Sheldon Johnson Jr. had become a model for how someone could turn their life around in prison. He was one of those redemption stories everyone wants to believe is possible. He was born in Harlem to deaf parents, a biracial couple he says were stigmatized. His Nigerian father abandoned them when he was 3 years old and left his Italian mother to pick up the pieces. With her lack of hearing, keeping a job was nearly impossible for her. The family was so poor and Johnson's clothes were so small and worn out. Because he was so tall and skinny, everyone at school made fun of him by calling him Slinky. He says no one knew how to deal with his bad behavior back then, so they stuck him in a psychiatric unit and then shuttled him to a series of group homes. He ended up dropping out of school and was on the streets by the sixth grade. He never got to be a child because he was always trying to protect his mother and work to feed his sisters. Eventually, one of the major gangs took him in and made him feel important. He says he still has the scar on his face and the stab marks to prove it. They bought him new clothes and gave him some self-worth as he rose through the ranks. In the 1990s, he was still basically a kid but was at the top of his game, dealing drugs on consignment. As in, he would give someone drugs, and after they sold the drugs, they would bring the money back to him. Well, Johnson was wrapped up in a felony weapons case in 1994, and with him in jail for that, his partners felt like they didn't need to pay him. What was he going to do to them? But his case was dismissed, so when he got out, he found his partners and demanded his money. The first guy wasn't interested in paying, so Johnson and his boys robbed the guy and his girlfriend. Johnson saw this as simply making them even. You took my drugs, I took your jewelry. But one of the boys hit the guy in the head with a gun, and the injury required stitches. And evidently the guy reported it to the police because the next thing Johnson knew, the guy had picked out his photo in a police array. At the time, Johnson said he was living an illegal life, and the guy was living an illegal life, and he just felt like it was sort of an eye for an eye situation. Based on the morals and principles of their world, the guy never should have ratted him out. He said what he did was permissible at the time in his game, but in the real world, he was arrested in December 1997. Johnson doesn't seem to tell this part of the story, but apparently when he robbed another partner around the same time, he shot the guy, but the man lived. Just before Johnson went to trial for these robberies, he was offered a plea deal of 23 years, but his lawyer said the max he would get if he was found guilty was 25 years, and if he took the deal, he wouldn't be able to appeal. The two-year difference between the plea deal and the max at trial didn't seem worth it. So he went to trial, and it wasn't 25 years that he got, it was 50. 25 years for each of the armed robberies, to be served consecutively. He said as his sentence was read, it almost felt surreal to him, like it couldn't be happening. Johnson was barely old enough to drink, and he realized he would probably die there in prison.
And he just called me a menace to society, and he gave me 50 years. And I remember when I first got to Downstate, which is a processing facility, and they give you what they call is a time computation sheet. And on the time computation sheet, it gives you all of the numbers, like the beginning of your bid, how much jail time you have. And I just remember 2049. That's all I kept looking at. And I was like, 2049? Are they fucking serious? This is 1998, 1999. And I'm trying to do the math, and I'm just like, 2049. I'm like, that's 50 years from now. And something just says, look up life expectancy. And I look up my life expectancy. And as an African-American man, my life expectancy at that time was 67 years old, and I did the math. And I said, I'm going to die in prison, man. I just really believed that I was going to die in prison.
But he noticed that some people were at their worst in prison, and some people were at their best. Some guys were getting an education and providing education to others. They were running the substance abuse programs and anti-violence groups. But he was at the top of the food chain in his gang, running what he called his own nation of guys. It's hard to give that up. But after being in and out of solitary confinement so many times, after having all of his privileges taken from him yet again, he looked down and saw the bread and milk in front of him one day. He said they call it the loaf, a hunk of bread with vegetables baked into it that's basically the guard's last resort in prison. When they've taken everything else from you, all they can do is take away your calories. He asked himself if he could really live that way for another 48 years. He had a wife and a son back home, and his little boy was hearing stories about his notorious dad stuck in prison. He didn't want to be that guy. He decided that he would leave the gang, and he didn't care what the consequences were. He decided that he'd done bad for so long, he was going to give good a shot. He got his GED and his associate's degree. He left his gang, and he started aggression replacement training. He stopped smoking, both weed and the 30 cigarettes a day he was used to. He starred in prison theater performances, exploring his days in lockup and his relationship with his parents on the stage.
I've been chiseling at these shackles, chains, restrictions, restraints, manacles for decades now. And if these walls could talk, they would tell you that I'm still afraid to let anyone in. That I'm tired of crying granite tears that roll and stumble, breaking everything in their path. If these bricks could talk, they would tell you I can endure the how, as long as there's a why. If this corridor could talk, it would tell you that I regret so much, and I wish that I could no longer see the past in my future. I blamed you as a mother for your bad decisions, decisions I have paid for with interest. If you hear me, I forgive you. And here I am again, calling out your name to free me from my past, illuminate my future, grant me a gift of peace in the present. But unfortunately, you cannot hear me.
He won arguments on the prison debate team. He edited a literary magazine. He became more mature and reevaluated the morals and principles that had landed him in jail. He said it takes courage to change, and that if he could, he would tell his former self, "Show me how tough you really are." In 2008, when Johnson was years into trying to turn his life around in prison, his 14-year-old son got in trouble with the law just like he had. The son, also named Sheldon, was out with friends in Harlem and decided to mess with people, just to be stupid. Sheldon III punched a random man in the head, and that man stumbled off the sidewalk and into the street, where he was hit by an SUV. The man died, and security cameras had caught it all. Police called the boy a cold-blooded predator with little capacity for remorse. He pleaded guilty to manslaughter and got 18 months in a juvenile detention boot camp. He had killed a man and gotten 18 months, while his dad, at just a few years older, had gotten 50 years. That disparity was not lost on the elder Sheldon Johnson. In 2022, he wrote a letter to the Manhattan DA asking for his help with securing an early release. In New York, the governor can grant clemency to prisoners once half their sentence has been served and they've made exceptional efforts in self-improvement. Johnson said he was hoping to come work with the DA's office upon his release. He wrote, "Mr. Bragg, I believe in change. I am a product of change. I believe that anything that does not change is not alive. I've spent the last 25 years in introspection, heavy reflection, self-rehabilitating. I am an advocate against gang recruitment and violence. I have created a number of programs that are geared toward helping at-risk youth identify the culture associated with gang violence and addressing deep-seated traumas that push these children into the streets where they end up making terrible, life-altering decisions." He said he had solutions for the national crises of incarceration and gun violence. With no word from the DA, Johnson continued to campaign on his own behalf. He filed as many motions as he could throughout his time in prison, motions to overturn and motions to vacate. It was during the process of filing one of these that he met attorneys from the Center for Appellate Litigation. They have a program to help people who were locked up at a very young age get more reasonable sentences as older adults. They helped Johnson create a mitigation packet that would show the life circumstances that led to his crime. They pointed to the work he'd done since then to take accountability and better himself. They filed a new motion to vacate his sentence. and the Manhattan DA agreed that the sentence didn't fit the crime. Johnson was released in May 2023 after serving more than 25 years. Now Johnson got to work with the Queens Defenders, a group of attorneys and social workers who not only help families with legal resources, but also do community outreach with local organizations and law enforcement. He counseled at-risk kids and got to shake hands with the Manhattan DA he wrote that letter to in 2022. He posed beside the CFO of the Brooklyn Nets. He was proof that you could come out of prison a better person. On the Joe Rogan podcast in February 2024, the executive director of the Perlmutter Center for Legal Justice called Johnson a miracle and a marvelous human being. He denounced the African-American judge who put Johnson away for 50 years. He downplayed Johnson's robbery, calling it a crime in which the victim received two stitches. He said two attorneys from the Center for Appellate Litigation called him to see if he would help with Johnson's appeal. He was shocked to see the 50-year sentence, and was astounded by the mental wherewithal it must take for a man to accomplish all that Johnson had in prison. He said Johnson had taken responsibility for what he did, and his case highlights how insanely broken the criminal justice system is. But then on March 5th, 2024, people in an apartment building in the Highbridge neighborhood of the Bronx in New York City heard a terrifying exchange just after 8 p.m. They heard a man say, "Please don't," and "I have a family," and then there were two shots. At first, neighbors didn't think much of the shots because they live near an expressway and their elevator makes a grinding noise. They're used to the building being loud. But one woman couldn't get over the fact that she heard someone asking to have his life spared. So two neighbors got together and called the building superintendent, who called for a welfare check. The super said he was concerned about the presence of a man no one recognized, who was seen entering the apartment with cleaning supplies and a mop. The man brought a blue bin into the unit at 2 a.m. and never brought it back out. And most suspiciously, he kept changing clothes as he came and went. When he left in the car belonging to the man who lived in the apartment, surveillance video showed him returning to the building in a blonde wig. And every time he arrived, he used a key to get in, like he owned the place. The man was, of course, 48-year-old Sheldon Johnson. When police did an initial check on the victim, they must not have seen anything suspicious out in the open to arrest Johnson on. He was in the apartment at the time and answered the door willingly. The New York Post reports that police actually apologized to him, like, "Sorry, somebody called, so we had to come." After they left, Johnson told someone in the building that he was looking for the super. And the super wonders what would have happened if Johnson had found him. He thinks he could have been asked to get rid of the security camera footage for the building or, worse, killed. Luckily, the police returned before that could ever happen. They had a warrant to search the apartment this time, and they found a body. It was in that blue bin, a torso missing its head and arms. Inside a freezer, they found the remaining parts. Johnson had dismembered the body. The head, in a plastic bag, had a single gunshot wound. They found the victim's car near Johnson's apartment in Harlem. He had hacksaw blades inside his home. Johnson was arrested and held without bond. As he was leaving the police precinct on the way to his arraignment on March 7th, he proclaimed his innocence. He's been charged with murder, manslaughter, criminal possession of a weapon, and concealment of a human corpse. He pleaded not guilty, and at the time of this recording, is being held without bail.
Sheldon Johnson, the suspect, says that he was a high-ranking member of the Bloods, but says that was his old life. He had changed now, or so prosecutors and police thought. That's until they found body parts inside his freezer.
48-year-old Sheldon Johnson claiming his innocence after being walked by police in handcuffs. He has been arraigned on several charges, including concealment of a corpse and murder, and was ordered to be held without bail.
The victim was a 44-year-old man named Colin Small. He was last seen on March 5th entering his apartment. His building super never saw him leave again. The NYPD chief of detectives says that Colin and Sheldon Johnson grew up together in Harlem and later did time together at the Sing Sing prison north of New York City. At one point, they were both using the same alias, so they must have been friends. Authorities found a kilo press in Colin's apartment that likely would have been used to package drugs, so they wondered at first if a dispute stemmed from that in some way. Colin's family says that the men were arguing over money, like one of them owed the other. Colin had served almost 10 years for felony assault before being paroled. The super said he had seen the two men together before, being friendly. Colin's family says that he was helping Johnson get acclimated to life on the outside. A neighbor says Colin will be missed and described him as having great energy.
it's going to be heartbreaking walking past that door every day and not having that, have a good day, or how you doing, how's everything? You know, it's just be an empty feeling now, and it's just going to be covered with such dark energy. And I just wanted to put out there that he had a great energy about him.
One of Johnson's neighbors called him a quiet but well-dressed guy that he assumed had a professional career. When Johnson was caught, he was apparently wearing that Tyvek suit you see in his arrest photos. One person in law enforcement told the New York Daily News, it looked like he had watched all of the movies about serial killers who cut up bodies.
Say hello to the neighbors?
He actually did not, but you could see a person when he's just walking his little dog, minding his business, he's well-dressed, it looks clean. You are assuming that this guy has a professional career, that he just went to work, came back, walking his dog, and continued with his personal life. Never in a million years I would have thought that I would be having this interview and seeing that picture.
And what if I tell you that this guy was a client advocate at the Queens Public Defender's Office?
Wow. That is quite a turnaround. Something went wrong. There was a switch somewhere that flipped them from the good side to the bad side. Oh my. Guy held that position? That's a position in which you have to be trustworthy with the community that you work with.
Sheldon Johnson's story has been removed from the New Yorkers for Clemency website, where he was described as a creative writer, thespian, and community mentor. That website, which petitions for New York's governor to release prisoners, once said Johnson should be home. I'll bet they didn't anticipate how poorly that would age. When I see websites like that, it just makes me sad that so many people were on this guy's side. So many people were fighting for his freedom using their good names. So many people put their time and effort into him when it could have been spent on someone else. He let them all down. It reminds me of that famous scene from America's Next Top Model where Tyra screams, I was rooting for you. We were all rooting for you.
Looks can be deceiving. I'm hurt. I am. But I can't change it, Tyra. I'm sick of being disappointed. When my mother yells at this, it's because she loves me. I was rooting for you. We were all rooting for you. How dare you?
Johnson's father, Sheldon Sr., blames himself for the decades of despair the family has been in. He picked up drugs as a young married man, and his addiction only deepened by the time he became a father. He abandoned his first family, and then a second, and was arrested in 1986 for assaulting his 7-year-old stepdaughter 3 times. He only got probation for that, which is gross, but he later served time for drug possession. He told BuzzFeed, generation to generation, it all stems from me. I feel disappointed. I regret a lot of the decisions I made in life. It enters my mind all of the time. A big, huge amount of guilt. I ruined everything. BuzzFeed wrote an entire long-form article about these guys. Everyone wanted it to get better for them. Reverend Peter Cook, who leads a council of churches that supports prison reform, told the New York Times, I grieve for the family mourning this tragic loss. It's important that we not lose sight of the fact that countless formerly incarcerated people have safely returned home and dedicated their remaining years to giving back to their community and promoting healing and safety. And he's right. The real shame is the tarnish this puts on other prisoners bettering themselves and seeking leniency. The Prison Policy Initiative writes that each year in prison takes 2 years off a person's life expectancy. The world is a better place for everyone if prisoners can be reformed. But cases like this don't make a person hopeful. Brian Stanley at Avenues for Justice fights to keep young offenders out of prison and says he hopes we can separate the horrible thing Johnson allegedly did and the great work he was doing. He said, we can acknowledge the depravity and insanity of this and at the same time be able to look at a broader picture and see the general impacts of the kind of work that we do and that even Mr. Johnson was engaged in. The trauma that people experience while incarcerated, I just think it's something that the general public is not really wrapping their mind around. I do feel sympathy for Sheldon and the generational trauma that follows this family. I'm just sad he apparently couldn't turn things around. Sheldon Johnson will be back in court next on April 2nd, 2024. Thank you for tuning into my podcast episode. I'm just a true crime fan like you are, and I really appreciate you taking a chance on me. Please subscribe and tell a friend if you like spending this time together. You can also find me on YouTube in the flesh by searching Katie Does Crime.